When 30 to 40,000 sheet masks turn up for your first order, you better have a good plan to sell them.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters. I'm Shuang Esther Shan, and this is your companion for starting and scaling a business. How does a viral moment change your business? Nick Jonas told GQ that he cannot live without the bro mask. That's when Jen Yu and Alex Penfold knew their bet on men's skincare has paid off.
The first thing that we did was making a pretty bold decision about really calling this out that this was for men.
We call it serious skincare that doesn't take itself too seriously.
Jackson Lane creates high-performing yet approachable skincare products tailored to men.
We don't want to launch a product unless we feel it's better than everything in the same category for women as well.
I've got both Jen and Alex with me today to share the practical advice you need to develop effective products and PR relationships that pay dividends. Jen, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shreng. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I'm so excited to have you both here. I love love stories and I love featuring founders who are life and business partners. Your dynamic actually inspired this business because, Jen, you were a little bit sick of Alex stealing your skincare products. Yeah, so talk to us about that light bulb moment of how Jackson Lane came to be.
So that is how it started. Alex, like a lot of couples, I think, was always dipping into my skincare and almost felt like the more expensive or premium skincare, the more he wanted it, right? So yeah. I'd come home and it's 3 p.m. on a Wednesday afternoon, he's got a sheet mask on, he's in bed enjoying his, you know, enjoying his best time, enjoying my skincare. And so I think we asked each other at the time, why isn't there a men's skincare brand that's marketed to men that feels approachable for them, but is actually excellent quality product? Everything at the time was just not, it was like dyed blue and kind of ugly packaging, and it wasn't as good as what was available for women, which is why they were all stealing their partner's products. And so we said, let's go make his favorite product, a sheet mask, but customize it for men. And I know he was having struggles with the fit of the masks at the time.
Yeah, if I ever had any facial hair, all the masks at the time were one piece. So then they would hang over the facial hair and it just wasn't really compatible. And so we really thought there was an opportunity here to design a mask with the man's face in mind. So we flew off to Korea to really design a sheet mask with a man's face in mind and give them the option of doing just the top half or both the top and the bottom piece. So that was the beginning.
So exciting. And I know that, you know, this idea sounded great to the both of you, but how did you validate beyond, you know, you guys to make sure other people were also thinking like, okay, you know what? I do actually want skincare that's more tailored to me, tailored to men and with their needs in mind.
I think at the time, you know, skincare was growing in popularity amongst men, sort of the final frontier. Mm-hmm. Like men are interested in their, you know, their health, their hair, their beard, going to the gym. But then the skin, you know, the facial skincare was being sort of left behind a little bit. But it was a definitely a growing area. And, you know, for me with the sheet mask, when I put that sheet mask on, it was definitely the first time. It was the first time that I really realized what a good skincare routine could give you. Because it really, you know, it doesn't last very long. It lasts for 2 or 3 days, the sort of the glow that you get from putting the sheet mask on. But, you know, it's sort of a shortcut to the potential of what a good skincare routine could look like. And so, you know, it's been a great introductory product for a lot of people where, you know, they're like, oh, wait a second, now I'm going to start getting into moisturizers and serums and eye creams and different things like that to you know, build upon what they've realized from the beginning there, so.
It's so exciting that the both of you jumped on a plane to actually talk to producers, manufacturers, to bring this idea to life. What were you thinking before preparing for this trip?
So I think for us, that actually came at the end of a year of trying to source online. So I think like a lot of other entrepreneurs, it's like you want to find it on the internet and make it easy. And so we did this for a year. We're sourcing products from Korea, from Japan, from China, all these different places. And nothing that came back was the quality that we would be proud to, you know, sort of build a brand behind. So eventually we realized we really had to go in person. And once we got to Korea, we realized that because Asia is such a big market for Korea, right? Korea's the beauty capital of the world, but they make all of their sales selling to countries like China because the market's so big. So they didn't have a big focus on selling to American companies. And so that's why it was like you couldn't get the good stuff online. So when we went there, like we knew exactly what SKU we wanted. It was a hydrogel sheet mask. We went to a trade show. lined up all the manufacturers that make that specific product, met with all of them, sampled all the products, and then finally chose the one that we wanted to work with. And I think this is, you know, when I speak to a lot of other people who are starting businesses these days, this is the part that everyone is sort of shocked to hear. It's like, oh, you actually have to physically go there. And it's not just about sort of finding a thing. It's also relationship building with a lot of these manufacturers. If you've never sold anything and you want to buy like a few hundred units, like they're just not, there's no incentive for them to invest mm-hmm. in that business or that relationship. And so mm-hmm. I think being there in person really helps that as well, build that trust factor.
Yeah. Well, for them, it's, you know, they don't know the growth potential yet right. of Jackson Lane. And for that process, right, you're finding the right partner. You're also trying to work with them to iterate, to create something new. What is some advice there when you're trying to communicate with someone who don't really need your business because they have a huge market close by, but you're trying to convince them to take a chance on you?
I think at the time, you know, there's a lot of manufacturers that saw the opportunity in the men's market specifically, and, you know, people having trouble tapping into it. And so there was a promise for us on our end where it was like, oh, here comes the opportunity. You know, maybe Jen and Alex can make it happen. So there was probably a little bit more of a willingness to go along with us because we were not there. I don't think there were any other people knocking on their door pitching what we were. And then, you know, for us to we had to put our commitment on the line because sheet masks in particular have a very high minimum order quantity because of the way that the rolls spin out. And so when 30 to 40,000 sheet masks turn up for your first order, you know, you realize that, you know, you better have a good plan to sell them. So,
were you guys just covered in boxes in your house? There were just...
Well, no. So the first order, because it was so many, it was like pallets and pallets of stuff. And so we had to start with a 3PL, which is a third-party logistics company, right? Where they ship out products for brands. So we were sort of forced into trying to make it scale from day one because we just had no option. We're like, this stuff is going to expire in a couple of years. Like we need to move some volume. So,
Wow. What an exciting jumpstart to all of that, right? And then I guess like taking a step back on formulation, what is like the biggest differentiator that you've found when you're thinking about formulating with men in mind versus a traditional skincare brand that caters mostly to women?
So men do have thicker skin. So, you know, the formulation, you know, can benefit from being a little bit stronger with active ingredients. Mm-hmm. We also have a focus on sort of inflammation. Shaving, for instance, can cause redness. And so calming ingredients that can help with soothing. We've really, you know, tried to focus on hyperpigmentation, evening of skin tone, which through speaking to our dermatologist partners, that's what the men are coming into their offices and talking about and, you know, voicing concern about. And so a lot of our formulation has been, you know, from feedback that we've received from dermatologists.
I think another piece is obviously with men, it's like the products have to work because a lot of men, they're not really doing skincare for the, like women do, right? With the consistency and just sort of, you just know it's part of your process. You enjoy the pampering, the experience. And so for us, it's really making sure that the products work, they're effective within the first couple of weeks, you start to see a difference. And also a lot of our male customers, they don't like stuff that feels heavy or greasy, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, we make sure all of our products absorb easily, like our sunscreen's very lightweight. And obviously for the masks, they're functionally sized up and the eye gels as well for men.
Mm-hmm. Love it. I did start the day with some eye gel, the bro eye mask, if you will, very calming. So yeah. I can attest to that. And I think, you know, when you're iterating with new partners, there is that tension between launching and perfection. So how do you find that balance where you're kind of like, I am happy and I need to be ready to launch now and commit to those 30,000 masks?
Yeah, I think that...
Well, I was just going to say, we may be overly involved in testing because we do go back and forth multiple times. And I think for some of our products, you know, I think for companies that are VC-backed and really have this pressure to them to just grow with product release, go, 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 go. I do think products are released quite quickly without this back and forth. And so there's an in-between between with us trying to perfect this product through going back, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 rounds of back and forth with the manufacturers to really, you know, get the, you know, the formulation perfect. But, you know, I think that's been really,
it's really critical to, I think, our successes because we don't want to launch a product unless it's we feel is better than everything in the same category for women as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason the manufacturers are willing to do this now, I don't think they would have done this like our first run, right? And we did not do this in our first run. And over time, we've actually switched manufacturers. I think in the beginning, we did partner with one that was probably too big for us and didn't want to do all these things that we're asking them to do.
Yeah.
And so over time, as we grew bigger, we've gone back to Korea. We still make a trip back there at least once a year. And since then, we've moved on to smaller businesses that are almost more like us, where it's like, you know, smaller team, younger team that really like is invested in trying to build something together. And I think through those relationships, that's how we're able to really like get the perfection because they're willing to do these things with us. And then once we, you know, we started getting the awards for the products, they started seeing all the press and they're like, oh, wait, like this is actually like it's something that they feel proud to be behind as well. And so I think that's really helped us is finding like people that are willing to partner with you.
Yeah, because they get excited about the growth as well.
Totally.
Yeah.
They love the celebrity moments. Like, they, you know, sometimes they'll send it to us and we're like, oh, you're following this as well.
And I also, just in our previous visit to Korea, we learned also too that they have been surprised about the longevity of our product because especially in South Korea where, you know, skincare is a trending product and so viral skincare goes and for 6 months, there'll be just an amazing run on it, but then it just completely switches and they'll close down the product category.
Yeah.
With a lot of these brands. And so we are, you know, sort of the number two hydrogel purchaser with this very large factory. And year after year, we've consistently sold, you know, a lot of our bromask eye gels, our sheet masks. You know, I think that they're just like, we don't know how you guys keep on doing this year after year because everybody else, they just come and it's a 6 month run. And if it doesn't go viral any longer, they'll close it down and that will be the end of the product. So that was kind of a good moment for us. We were like, oh, wow, thank you. You know, we're excited that, you know, we've been able to differentiate ourselves and keep people coming back for more. So, yeah.
Yeah, you've come a long way since that initial 30, 40,000 masks landing here. I do want to get an understanding of like, now that you have the product, you're happy with it. How did you get customers and launch this thing?
So I think like many other entrepreneurs, we launched a family and friends, which is crickets. Basically, you got a few, you know, a couple of people are like, oh, I'll help them out and place an order. And I think both of us were first-time entrepreneurs and neither of us were marketers. And so, you know, we're bootstrapping. We didn't have the budget to be spending tens of thousands of dollars on Facebook ads. And then one day we had a friend, one of our family and friends, email friends, reach out and say, I want to do PR for you guys. And so she was at an agency at the time and loved the idea behind the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so she gave us a great rate because she was a friend. And that was our publicist for the first 2 or 3 years. So we, from day one, have had consistent PR. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of startup entrepreneurs, they're looking at the cost of doing PR, right? And it is like a daunting amount of money, especially to think about doing a long term. And what I realized too is PR is not a thing where you can turn it on and in 3 months, you're like in all these magazines, right? It really is a long term commitment. And it has to be for the right product has the potential for people to want to talk about it in press. So for us, that's really been one of our first ways of getting a brand out there. And so in the beginning, she started doing things like gifting celebrities, right? And I think ultimately that's how Nick Jonas found out about the brand was because he'd received a gift and loved the product enough to make it part of his daily routine. And I think another big moment for us that drove both customers to purchase product but also drove inbound retail was, I would say 6 months in, we were interviewed by the Wall Street Journal for a broader piece. It wasn't about us. It was about just men doing sheet masks in general.
It was about men being, you know, not only are they doing skincare, but now they're doing sheet masks. Like, this
like
is unbelievable.
How outrageous, you know? That men are also doing sheet masks. It was like, this is 2018, I think. It was like unthinkable, right?
Mm.
That gave us a good amount of exposure as well. And from then on, I think it was just, you know, we do, I think, similar things to what most other brands do, which is, you know, you have to do the ads and, you know, we do the email marketing, SMS marketing, all these things that we built on over time. But I think having that initial like exposure to a large number of people that we couldn't have gotten with our own budget was really helpful.
And we also can't forget the micro influencers, right?
Yes.
So at the very beginning, when we started, sheet masks were definitely trending in America at the time. So there was a moment in time where sheet masks were a big thing. There were people that were reviewing a different sheet mask every single day. And so that was their thing. Like they would do a new sheet mask every day. And, you know, there weren't any sheet mask designed with men in mind. And so we contacted all of these micro-influencers and said, hey, would you like to try this? And they'd be like, yeah, sure, I can't wait to tear this apart, you know, because they're really difficult, like, you know, in terms of they give ratings and all this type of system. And then they, you know, got it and put it on. And I think they were like, wait a second, this is a legit sheet mask. You know, this is, if not the best one I've used, you know what I mean? And so a lot of the writers that are writing for magazines were actually following some of these micro-influencers. And then they then would reach out to our publicist or to our team directly and just be like, hey, I just saw, you know, this review about the sheet mask. Can you please send me one? I'd love to try it. And sort of it grew from there.
I love that anecdote because it also shows how much prep you have to get those PR mentions because, you know, seeding micro-influencers, that leads you to more publications noticing you. So I guess, like, what are some other things you did to prep yourself to be ready to be written about? Because, you know, your site, your imagery, everything is so easy to be understood and also easy to feature as well.
The first thing was calling it Bromask. Now, this, so basically, you know, this, we went back and forth on this a lot because we didn't want to be the bro brand or, you know, the kind of like, you know, like college frat boy type situation. We want it to be like a mask that a man would stop and say, ask questions to the retailer. Mm-hmm. When you're on the shelf, you know, men walking by, they're not really into skincare. Maybe they're going to stop and read the back of this box and figure out what this is about. And so that was literally the first thing that we did was making a pretty bold decision about, you know, really calling this out that this was for men. Obviously, our branding and everything we've done to try to, you know, balance that with class is mm-hmm. has been the challenge of our branding is to really deliver on a premium product that can be on the shelf at Saks Fifth Avenue and succeed and you know, also be something that, you know, we can come out with other products that are not named with a bro title, for instance, like our sunscreens and our moisturizers, our serums that are you know, more unisex in nature.
Yeah, because I think there's also an element of education for this category, right? Where you're trying to be entertaining and fun, but you're also trying to weave in just like how to embrace skincare for men. Yeah. So how do you balance those two sides in your content and everything that you do?
I think that's still a bit of a challenge for us. What we do is we do make very, we call it serious skincare that doesn't take itself too seriously, right? And so it's fun to do the like fun captions, but ultimately the education part is hard because we're not dumbing down the products to make it easier for people to understand, right? They're obviously very nice to apply, not difficult to use, but formulation-wise, like, they're really excellent products. An example is our sunscreen. We wanted to launch a sunscreen, and I really felt strongly that it had to be SPF 50 because, you know, if you truly want to prevent the signs of aging and all of that, it needs to be, like, well above 30, right? And I think at the time, people were saying to us, that's crazy, like, men don't want that because they want to get a little color. We felt really strongly that we need to make a product so great, so lightweight to put on that SPF 50 doesn't feel like SPF 50. And so I'm not sure that we've completely solved for the customer education while balancing the funness of it. But I think that's also sort of what we are known for is, you know, people are getting the Bromask expecting it to be something ridiculous and not very good. And then they're like, oh, wait, this is actually like excellent. And it's sort of that like jarring sort of experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you guys are doing a really great job at it. And it's a constant process. Every single post, you have to think about that element as well. And I know that, you know, skincare is very much a ritual, which is great because the lifetime value of a customer ideally would be ongoing and ever flowing. But how do you think about retention when it comes to loyalty programs and ambassador programs?
Yes. So that's a great question. Loyalty and retention is something we really started hyper-focusing on this year. Because as many of your listeners would know, it's like acquisition costs for ad spend to get new customers has just like risen exponentially over the last few years, right? And so we launched a loyalty program earlier this year. And so, you know, you can accrue points to make purchases and refer friends, et cetera. We offer subscriptions and that's something that we'll continue working on as well. And I think generally what we try to do is just have like incredible customer service, right? Like we're competing with Amazon, right? We all sell on Amazon, but it's like, you know, we try to get the products out with 2-day shipping if possible. We have free shipping. Mm-hmm. Like we'll do for our customers that have ordered many times, we throw in surprise gifts for them. We write them handwritten notes. I mean, it's, you know, and we do everything we can do to help our customer be successful in their skincare journey and just like enjoy shopping with us.
Alex, maybe talk to us about the ambassador program. Who do you look for and what are you thinking about for people to represent the brand?
Yeah, so we honestly have always pursued influencers and, you know, ambassadors that really are fans of our brand. That has been always the strongest thing. I think that's probably common for a lot of brands, is that when you're looking for someone to speak to your brand, you need to make sure that they are already a supporter of you. And if not, you can kind of read it. So when you're speaking to them and interviewing them for a potential retainer, for instance, on TikTok to try to have them posting regularly, you know, does this person love your brand? Are they with you on the journey? And do they really believe in you? Because it shows through.
Especially today on TikTok, it's like everybody's, it's authenticity. It's like you can smell it, you know, immediately when you see an influencer, you know, like, does this person really believe in this thing or are they just doing it for money? And so I think that's what it is for us when we're looking for ambassadors. It's like, there has to be authenticity.
There was a time where we were sending out a lot of product to a lot of different influencers and we just weren't seeing great traction. And so we are trying to pivot more now towards, you know, having folks that are, you know, people that we've more like interviewed and more like a careful selection process to promote the products.
Taking it back to that, you know, those viral moments with Nick Jonas and Niall Horan, I think those moments are great, but it's also about how you build on that momentum and grow from there. So I guess, what's your advice when something exciting happens and now you're kind of also have to figure out the back end and like be ready to actually account for the interest that's inflowing into your business?
Well, I think, you know, it takes like a team of folks basically to promote something effectively. And then you also have to be quite careful about, you know, when something does happen organically, do you even have permission to promote this in the way that you want to? So you kind of have to look into this a little bit. So, you know, you just say you win a grooming award, you know, you have to pay the publishing company to actually license out the ability to tell anyone about the fact that you won the award.
Wow.
And so, you know, there's a lot of sort of back-end logistics that goes into play. And then once you figure out and secure all the licensing and make sure that it's okay to promote it, then you can go live out on all your channels to really promote it and make the most of it. So,
Yeah, legal is very important. You got to get those releases. Yeah, for sure.
Things we didn't know in the very beginning, but it is like very important to do that.
For sure. Attuned to those legal releases, there's also the management of just logistics and cash flow and making sure you have a runway to keep on going. What's your advice there to make sure you're in a good financial state?
Well, I think, you know, so we have been looking at that very closely over the last 6 to 8 months because, you know, we, for instance, we're doing very well on Amazon for many years and we just weren't really monitoring the advertising spend and the profitability as closely as we should be. And so that's something that for instance, you know, we're really taking action. We've had great results as a result of actually, you know, really drilling down on these numbers. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, on our other channels, like, you know, our G2C channels like Shopify and retail, we have had to make some hard decisions. We have had to pull out of some great retailers because of, you know, cash flow concerns on staffing members at department stores and, you know, seeing the numbers of like how many people are even walking by, for instance, versus how much you're paying in a salary to have the person standing there to market your product. You know, it can be, you say, oh, this is a great marketing position here to have your product in this store, but then actually, is it cash flow positive? And if it's not, then you have to, you know, make some decisions about whether or not it's worth pursuing or not. So
I think it's a great point. And for us, it's when you're, especially when you're earlier on in the journey, it's like you just do anything that comes to you, right? So if a distributor came or a retailer came, we would say yes to every single thing. And being a small team, an omni-channel team, that's, you know, just the two of us really running the show, it's like it starts taking your eye off the ball where you can't do everything well. Mm-hmm. And so over the last couple of years, we are really trying to refine like what is it that we really want to do and want to focus on and really focus on growing that instead of just doing whatever came our way.
Yeah. And I think especially in this economic climate, profitability is key. Like even if you're talking to investors, they do want to see profitability before possibility. I think the whole shift has happened. So it's just so important.
Yeah.
But there are still great retail partners that you work with and also international partners. How do you go about like establishing those connections and making sure that they work for both the retailer and yourselves?
I think for us, some of our retailers were inbound from the press and all this kind of stuff, right? And otherwise, I mean, what I would normally do is I would look up a retailer that I want to partner with, and I'll go on LinkedIn and see if we have any mutual connections. And literally, that's how we ended up in a couple of our retailers, is finding somebody that was willing to give us the intro to that retailer. I think just like cold emailing people is always an option, but it's harder. You spend a lot more time to get fewer hits. And another thing we've done is we did a trade show one time, and that was helpful as well. It was a lot of work, but, you know, just being exposed to buyers was a...
Yeah, I think that was the Indie Beauty Expo in Los Angeles just before COVID hit. So this was literally in February of 2020, and we met Nima Marcus there. And well, it was fortuitous because it all worked out. And, you know, that was the last trade show before COVID hit. So we really snuck that one in. So, yeah.
Yeah. That really paid off. I'm always curious because it is such a big investment for founders to attend a trade show, invest in one. How did you decide to go to that one in particular?
At the time, Indie Beauty Expo was, I think, the best place for small brands to have a launch pad. And is also associated with Beauty Independent, which is a publication that is, you know, all things beauty related for news. And so we sort of had an affinity to that. We'd chatted with some of the editors and different things. And so we really felt like we had a connection and a reason to go to this one. And so, you know, I think that you need to be targeted in your approach. Like, is this convention too big for my brand at this stage? You know, in beauty, for instance, there's Cosmoprof, and you can be one of, you know, 10,000 vendors, and it's a very overwhelming in Las Vegas, and it's like a huge operation. But this was really intimate and focused, and really brought people in, you know, that mattered and who were looking for startup brands that were going to be the next thing. So, and also for us, it was in Los Angeles, so we're based in Southern California, and so it was much easier for us to pull off, you know, doing a trade show in New York. Like, we had a beautiful, you know, like set design and everything for this trade show, and so it looked fantastic. But, you know, us trying to do that in New York would have been much more difficult for us to accomplish at the time, because in that case, you really have to start pulling in a team of people to hire, right? And so it's not just you guys traveling to the trade show and doing what you're doing. You're now bringing in set designers and different things to really pull off a marketing event. So, you know, in a foreign city that you're not located. So,
just thinking about before COVID, there's so many new brands that have come into market during this period. Everyone was at home taking care of their skin, which is a great thing. But I feel like there's also more brands to compete against or to collaborate with. How are you thinking about the skincare space today?
I think it's interesting because I think being in marketing to men, it is definitely less crowded than the women's space, but we do see new competitors coming out all the time, right? Mm-hmm. But over the last few years, we've also seen competitors go away. And I think one of the things that we did differently than others was that we didn't raise money in the early days, right? So a lot of the brands that we saw, they raised a lot of money in the early days. And then when the ad costs went up a lot, right? They had salaries they had to pay for, these rising costs, and they couldn't continue raising more money to cover that. And then so ultimately, a lot of the brands have actually folded over the last few years because they just couldn't sustain both having all those people and then the rising costs as well. And so I think it is always interesting.
And the tightening of cash coming in.
Yeah. Tightening of cash, right? So yeah. No more money, right? So I think for us, we're still so early in the growth of the men's space, right? There's all this stuff like, you know, you read the metrics, like, you know, men's beauty is growing so much faster than the women's space, but at the same time, it's still very small in terms of penetration. Like, if you just think about the men that you know, most likely more than half don't have like a really good skincare routine, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, it's, even though you're always kind of like, oh, more competitors, you know, you get a bit nervous. At the same time, I think it's just like almost like the rising tide lifts all ships situation, where there just needs to be more adoption of this category in general, and having more people bringing great products to market helps that.
You got to surf those waves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, when we were chatting earlier, we were talking about the both of you working on this business and also being parents together. And I love the fact that you said it's work-life mix instead of balance. Yeah, talk to us about that philosophy.
So this is actually a topic that's very near and dear to me, because as a, you know, a female founder with kids and that's married, it's really, I think there's this idea you can, in the last few years, where you can be a girl boss, you can do it all and have all this stuff. And ultimately, you can't. I mean, you can do it all, but you can't. My experience is that you cannot do it all extremely well, because there's just not enough time in the day. And so for us, I don't believe that you can have something that's truly work-life balance, but that you kind of have to mix it together, right? And I think I mentioned this to you back when I was in my corporate job at Google. I attended a lunch and learn with our CFO, Ruth Pratt, at the time. And it's a question I asked her because she's so successful and she's three kids. So I said, how do you do it all? How did you become mm-hmm. the super successful person with these three kids? And so she said, it's work-life mix. Right? So you're at the soccer games, you're doing all this stuff, but you're working at the same time. And so I know it's not ideal, but that's the reality that we sort of live in is, you know, you can't expect that you're going to be at 100% on everything that you do.
Like, we were driving up here with the kids today, and because we dropped them off at my parents' house, but they were asking Jen questions. I was driving, and Jen was working on her phone. You know what I mean? And we even said, like, oh, it's so great that, you know, we have phones now where we can do this. But we sort of have to say, hey, guys, you know, mom's working right now. Like, we got to, you know, take a minute to get through this. And, you know, it is tough. And I would say there is a benefit to us being married, too, in the sense that we are able to constantly, you know, like come up with ideas and test things. And, you know, I was just testing new products this week. And so we're just literally in the same house testing these products. And it's like, we can cut through so much of the red tape back and forth. We need to set up a meeting to discuss this product and all this type of thing. And then, you know, of course, when we go to meet our retailer or our manufacturers in Korea and all that type of thing, we are traveling as a husband and wife. And, it, you know, we can have some fun at dinners too and different things together. So, yeah.
Yeah. Sounds nice and balanced while you're achieving this mix as well. Yeah. And I think like both of you were working full time for a period while launching Jackson Lane. At what point did you feel comfortable that you wanted to be full time entrepreneurs?
So we broke it up, actually. So I was working in medical device sales at the time. So I had this whole sales background. I was traveling around America. I was sort of in charge of the entire West Coast. So at the time, there was a lot of travel and, you know, trying to juggle both at the same time. But at the same time, I was kind of on my own a lot. And so I could, you know, do quite a bit of work, you know, while I was out and about. And then Jen, you know, she was working at Google, obviously, and that was a very demanding job and full-time too. So we had me step out first after 2 years. So for 2 years, we were both juggling, you know, these two jobs. We didn't have children at that stage though. And so then I went full-time and then Jen, you know, it felt like she was working full-time too, to be honest. Like I think that it really, you know, Jen really hung in there until, you know, about 6 months ago. And now she's come on full time too. But it's amazing to see, you know, how much, well, Jen has been working on Jackson Lane in the last 6 months, just thinking like, how did we even function before while she had this other full time job? Because like, you know, we can see the impact that this has had now that she's here with us full time, because I would say the whole trajectory of our company has changed in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. So it really does, you know, I think it takes a full-time commitment to make it work. But it's like when you have kids and a family and a mortgage and all these different things, it's like, how do you actually do that if you're not bringing in revenue profitability to support your lifestyle without, you know, going and eating the ramen, basically, you know what I mean? So
I think when I knew it was ready, was time to go, was that I could tell the business was starting to suffer because I was not able to be there. Because, you know, your like day job is always a priority, right? Someone's paying you. So I'm not the kind of person that can sit at my day job and like do a bad job, right? So I think, you know, I was doing a great job at work, but I think that was just giving us no time for me to work on Jackson Lane. So at that point, I was like, okay, it's, you know, we've been doing this for a few years and things are going well. Like we ran the numbers. And I think that's really important to people, you know, to the folks listening as well. It's like, you really have to write the numbers down, right? Like how much money do you need to realistically need to spend? Like how much do you have in savings? Like what money can you take out of the business? And is that good enough for you as a trajectory until it grows bigger?
Also, I think being in tech, there's just so much more luxuries that come with being in tech, you know, health benefits and those lunch and learns and all those other things. How do you kind of like feel comfortable with letting that go and taking on that risk?
I think for us, I mean, it's obviously, you know, painful not having some of those amazing perks that we, you know, we can't have for our own company. But as much as we can, I am trying to actually bring elements of that Google experience to Jackson Lane. So if you work at Jackson Lane, you know, you get free snacks.
Jen came in and started working in our office, you know, for the first time because she was always working remotely. Mm. And then she comes in, she's like, we need a snack section. We need like all these drinks.
I'm like, we need to merchandise the drinks in the fridge. It's got to be looking this way. Yeah. We have to have this. And I think it's, you know, beyond obviously the little things like the snacks, it's really thinking about like what kind of work culture we want. And that was one of the things I loved about being at least at Google, was it wasn't so much like this crazy hierarchical thing where you just have to say yes to your boss. It was very much like you can say what you think needs to be the right thing that needs to be done and mm-hmm. actually take actions to doing something that you think needs to get done, right? So I think it's also bringing in an element of that culture as well where you feel like good working there.
Yeah. And also, I'd say that, you know, if you think about it in terms of stages, so when Jen was working, you know, still at Google, and I was full-time on the business, I found myself getting really bogged down in operations. And so it was like, you know, trying to manage the business that was existing instead of really being able to think about growth. And so since Jen has come on board, I think the discussion has been more about like, okay, how do we delegate this, delegate that, so that we're not bogged down in all these operations and we can actually grow the vision. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's been, I'd say, one of the biggest changes since Jen, well, both of us are full time on the business. So.
And it's cool to create your own work culture as well and build out that team and just kind of like build the workplace that you want as well.
Yeah, that is really nice. I think that's, you know, that's sort of the advantage of being somebody that's had a couple of corporate careers before launching a business. It's kind of like, you know what you hated, you know what you love, and being able to take that and put it into your own business.
Well, I started off the show by saying that I love love stories and love stories that are building a business together. So I need to know about what are some things that have been the most helpful for you to navigate this, you know, work with a life and business partner?
Yeah, I think for us, it's been an amazing journey together because there's nothing more satisfying than doing this with somebody that is your partner, right? And I think for us getting through the challenges, it's hard sometimes not to mix your personal life with your business life, right? Like if you have a business partner who's not your family, you wouldn't go like take out your personal problems on your business partner, right? Yeah. But I think for us, like if we're having like a squabble at home about something, that's going to leak into our business relationship as well. And so that's been a really intentional effort for us. And like last year, we actually got a lot of couples counseling. So we did this like every week for a year straight. So we're able to have a third party person there help us work through like the way we communicate, like what are our true things that we're fighting about? How do we, you know, resolve things in a more healthy way? And I think for us now, it's like, I feel like it's a, like a 180 from before we did all this work because, you know, it's forcing us to grow as people and really think about how we're engaging with each other and how to be respectful and like make it a pleasant situation for both of us at home and with the company. And also, of course, like modeling it for your children, right? Because you don't want to be fighting in front of them and, you know, all this crazy stuff.
I think even if you're not married, like a business counselor at least or something like that would be really smart because a lot of companies don't succeed specifically because of partner conflict. And so, you know, not everyone is a husband and wife team, but there's plenty of, you know, conflict that exists in partnerships. If it's one, two, three people that are all friends, you know, then it starts getting conflict in the friendship, or maybe you're not that familiar with each other and then you get together and you need to get to know each other better. You know, so I would really suggest that. That was really great for us. So.
Partnerships, relationships, they're so important. Well, thank you so much, Jen and Alex, for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's been great.
That's Jen Yu and Alex Penfold, co-founders of Jackson Lane. I'm Shuang Esther Shan. Thank you so much for tuning in to Shopify Masters. Subscribe for new episodes every single week.